So I'm really excited tonight.
We're going to have a person come on up and talk and share that I met probably 20 years ago. I moved up to the Central Coast. My sponsor dragged me down to a little town called Los Alamos when there was like 3 people in this meeting. I was used to meetings in LA. Went down there and I got to hear what my sponsor would say, the language of the heart. And one of those people that spoke that was our speaker tonight, and just very assured and a lot of class. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any class. Well, I did, but you spelled it with a K. So without any further ado, you're going to hear Bunny talk tonight. So let's give her a warm round of applause, please.
There's
extra water right here, too.
Oh, great. Thanks. Hi, I'm Bunny. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bunny.
I feel very privileged to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be able to share my story for you and so that I can hear it. I need to continue to hear my story on a regular basis to remember where I came from and why I still keep coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got sober in Fresno, California. That's where I was born in San Francisco, and my family moved to Fresno when I was 2, and so that's where I grew up. And I lived over there until 1989, and that's when I moved over here. And my sobriety date is April 9th, 1979. I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous a day at a time for 35 years. And I remember my first meeting like it was last night. AA is just very, very precious to me and everything that's happened to me since the moment I got here. And what I was like, I grew up a really normal kind of kid. I was the second daughter in a family of 5. I have an older sister and then my brother's next after me and then 2 younger sisters. Irish Catholic family, really nice family, nice upbringing. My parents were like treated us really nice. Of course, when we didn't get what we wanted, we thought they were really mean and awful, but they were really wonderful, healthy people. And all the years I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous and all the stories that I've heard of my fellow alcoholics that are sober in AA, I'm more and more grateful that I was able to have the kind of upbringing and the family life that I did. I never didn't know that I was tremendously loved. I didn't, my parents didn't beat us or it just was really kind of like, I know you young people probably know what Ozzie and Harriet growing up is, but that was a TV show in the 50s and it was like this perfect little family, and that's what it was like. And I don't apologize for it. It was really wonderful. But I say that to say I didn't have any reason to start drinking. I wasn't trying to escape from anything. I had fun in school. I liked PE and art. I wasn't big on like math and that kind of stuff. And so I just didn't do it. But I liked recess. I liked to play. I had good friends. My best friend in the world, we met in kindergarten, so we've known each other for 61 years. And I have a lot of long-term, and she's not alcoholic. and so life was good, and I was a pretty good kid. I liked some mischief, but nothing like really bad. In the time that I grew up, we didn't know anybody in grammar. Nobody in grammar school did drugs or booze. They just didn't. And in junior high either. And so I went to Catholic grammar school from kindergarten to 8th grade, and then I got to go to public school. I really wanted to go to public school. And so I went to a year at a junior high. And we used to do things like that. We started like sneaking out in the middle of the night, and then I got caught. And I was looking at Henry's T-shirt. You know, it didn't count if you didn't get caught. But I got caught, and because we took my boyfriend's dad's Lincoln Continental and drove it around all night, and he actually got caught, and then this other girl ratted us all out. And so my parents were horrified that their little daughter was putting the window up in the middle of the night and running around the neighborhood with her, smoking cigarettes with her friends. And we were really, you know, we were really okay kids. So that was really painful to get caught for that. And of course, I said I'd never do it again. And then I think the very next weekend, I stayed over at a friend's house, and we snuck out of her parents because they didn't care. Snuck out of their house, and again, didn't do anything bad. Just ran around the neighborhood. And I got caught again, and that was really bad. So all through high school, I was really, really good. Really good, because my parents were very disappointed in me. And so in high school, the first time I got drunk, I was 16. Now, my parents drank, they had a couple drinks before dinner, or a drink before dinner. Most nights, my grandparents on my mother's side that lived in San Francisco were bad alcoholics. And in fact, after they, my grandfather had passed away in his early 60s, they called it heart failure. I called it alcoholism. You know, he basically retired, laid on his couch, smoked his pipe, drank, and died. And, you know, his heart failed because he drank himself to death is what happened. And my grandmother, we thought she'd follow him pretty quickly, but she lived to be 93. The last several years of her life, we moved her to Fresno with us, and she didn't get to have a drink. And so that was how she ended up. But she had spent some time in Napa State Hospital, which is a pretty serious mental hospital up north of San Francisco. And my parents had to commit her at one point because of her alcoholism. And my grandfather, they couldn't commit him because he was too lithid, too sharp. And so he told them the truth about how he drank and so forth. But they said, well, you know, to my parents, he could take him to a voluntary place. So my dad drove him to this voluntary dryout place up in the Bay Area, and he was going to stay a month. And my dad was doing business in the city, and he went up there the following week, and the lights were on in my grandparents' flat. And he went in, and my grandfather was sitting there drinking his Lucky Lager and smoking his pipe. So my dad said, you know, you got to dry out. So he drove him back to the dryout farm, and a week later we went back, and there was Poppy sitting on the couch drinking his Lucky Lager and smoking his pipe. So they gave up. He just didn't drink anymore. And my grandmother was in that mental facility for 3 months, and she finally got out and to drink again. And so if you saw my grandmother, she was very beautiful. She had tailor-made gray suits, hats, these big San Francisco lady hats, pearls, white gloves. And when I was little and I would go up to visit them in San Francisco, we would get dressed up and they lived in the marina. We'd walk down to Chestnut Street, which had a lot of shops and bars and stuff on it. And we would go to this place called the Horseshoe Club. And we'd go in there at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I had no idea about their drinking or alcoholism or anything when I was a kid. And we'd go in there and we'd sit at the bar, and the bartender would give her a coffee cup, and I assumed she was drinking coffee. But that's what they would do to ladies, for ladies. They'd give them their booze in a coffee cup. And she'd have her little gloves on, and they'd give me a Shirley Temple or orange juice or something. I thought it was great. You know, some old guy next to me gave me a dollar bill, and, you know, let's go down to Woolworths to the 5 and 10 and buy a little bag of Cowboys and Indians. And so, you know, life was good. But so that's the background. And for me, I've always believed that alcoholism is genetic. It certainly is in my case. And I think it skips. My best friend, like I told you about, does not have alcoholism. Can take it or leave it. Doesn't choose to drink booze very often, but when she does, she has a margarita. She doesn't want it to taste like tequila. And we went to a restaurant one night after I was sober, and she got I said, you know, I was driving, so she could have a drink. She wouldn't have a drink if she wouldn't have a drink if she was driving. I don't know. You could at least have a few. But so she ordered a margarita. She maybe has five or six a year. and doesn't always finish them. So she orders a margarita, and they bring her, I've never seen this before, they brought her a shot of tequila next to it. And I was kind of like, how cool. You know, it's really cool. And she said, what is that? And I said, well, it's an extra shot of tequila. And she said, what for? And I thought, you know, I'm so bodily and mentally different from my fellows. Like the big book tells me, I am, and it's always when I compare myself to my friend Susie, I am so alcoholic and she is so not. And that was helpful for me to make that kind of a comparison rather than trying to compare myself when I first came to meetings to other alcoholics. You know, my mind was saying, I didn't do that, I didn't do that, I didn't do that. So I first time I got drunk, 16 years old, and I went to a dance at the high school, and I went out with a guy who was a couple years older, and I didn't know we were going to be drinking. I wasn't looking to go drinking. Again, I still just didn't want to get in trouble with my parents or at school. And so before the dance, he parked out with... We used to go out in the figs. People would park their pickup trucks in between the rows of fig trees out by the high school I lived, or went to. Excuse me. And so we went out there, and he gave me a Colt 45, and I drank that, the little one, or Country Club Stout Malt Liquor, maybe it was. And didn't taste all that good. I'd sipped beer before and had sips of my parents' drinks and so forth. And then I started to feel pretty good. And so he said, do you want another one? Before I'd even finished that one, I said, no. And then I finished that one, and I said, yeah, I'll have another. And he gave me another one, and when I was halfway through it, he took it away from me because I was getting a little giddy. And so we went to the dance. I had a blast. I didn't get in trouble. I didn't do anything. But I was really aware for the first time, don't get caught. Don't be going up and talking to teachers or anything. I knew. You just don't want to, you got to hide this a little bit here. And so the dance went okay, went home, and my mom always sat up late at night watching TV, and I saw that she was up, and I said, drive around the block one more time. I'm like, sucking fresh air, and you know, and I just walked right in, right in front of her, sat down, and didn't try to hide from her, just sat down, started telling her what a fun time I had at the dance. She didn't say, gee, you smell like booze, or have you been drinking, or what's wrong with you? And I thought, without even thinking, I thought, I'm drunk and I don't look like it. And that was kind of the story of my drinking, too, was I'd be the last one standing at parties. I'd be the one that drove everybody home. I'd be the one that, for some weird reason, other than getting pulled over for drinking, I'd get pulled over for a taillight out or something after drinking for hours on end, and the cops would let me drive home. And so I did not look to seek out drinking much in my high school years at all. I can't even remember another time in my high school, except I think I went to some parents' cocktail party and had some drinks at that. But I didn't get drunk through high school, but when I was 18 and graduated from high school and started going to junior college in Fresno, I ended up within a couple weeks meeting the gals that drank really hard and heavy, and I started hanging around with them and skipping classes and skipping school altogether, and just drinking. And I worked for my dad at the time, and I remember going out to lunch with a old boyfriend, and we went to this beer and his beer joint by Fresno State, and just pretty much drank beer for lunch and had a sandwich. And I went back to work. I was supposed to go back at 1:00. I got back at 3:00, and my dad was out on the sidewalk tapping his toe. And I thought, you know what is a big deal? What's a big deal? What's fun? And where have you been? And I said, you know, we went to lunch. So. You know, I wasn't getting in any big heavy-duty trouble or anything, but when I was 21, I became an instant daily drinker. To get into the bars, I loved the bars, and if everybody wanted to go 7 nights a week, I'm in. And so I started doing a lot of bar drinking, and it was really fun. And we had this little town, Clovis, outside of Fresno, and I grew up riding horses, and so all the barn young kids that were 19, 20, 21, or 21, 22, we'd all go out there and just dance and drink, and we loved it. We were like the bar owners had a daughter our age, and so sometimes they'd invite us for dinner. It was just part of the family there. And life was good. Again, I didn't have any big problems in life that I was trying to escape from. But I have what I know now when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, what I found out, I have a physical allergy to alcohol that when I take any into my system, that I am going to keep drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking. And that I have a different kind of mind than a normal drinker. And so even though I might have had some horrible experience with drinking last night, that won't keep me from picking up a drink, you know, the very next day. And my whole story proves that to me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I began to tell my drinking story. And I drank pretty much daily from the time I was 21. I really drank daily from the time I was 21 till I was 31. I got to AA when I was 31 years old. And my plan was the last 3 years of my drinking was I called myself an alcoholic. And I decided that someday, probably when I'm in my 60s and I'm a grandmother, I'll have to like grow up and do something about this drinking thing. But not now, because it's too much fun. Mm-hmm. And I got here when I was 31, and I was afraid I'd waited too long, that this wouldn't work for me. And some of the incidents that happened in those last 3 years, my drinking was obviously progressing and going on this kind of slow downhill train. And the last 3 years, it was a little more steep. And the last 8 months of my drinking, it just plummeted. And I was putting myself in life-threatening situations. I didn't mean to. I just took a drink and went out to have fun. And by the end of the night, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, I've got somebody threatening my life, or I'm out with people that I wouldn't be seen caught dead being with. And I know when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I heard that part about lower companions, my sponsor told me that I was probably somebody's lower companion, and I was like, ooh, I hadn't thought of that. Probably was. But what happened for me too was that fooled me probably more than anybody was that I looked okay on the outside. And that is what is so insidious about alcoholism for some of us. I looked okay on the outside. I didn't have anybody in all my drinking years say anything. I wasn't a blackout drinker, so I would remember, but didn't have anybody ever say anything about my drinking, that it was a problem, that they thought I should slow down, nothing. And that's what almost killed me. I still had a great job. I don't know how much longer I would have had it for, but I had that. I had a new little sports car. I lived in a really nice place. I was going off on these ski trips to Colorado and Idaho and playing golf and had, you know, boyfriends. And that was the stuff that I thought was important. And what was the main thing that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous was I thought, and I weighed like about 80 pounds less. It finally dawned on me that, Bunny, you know what? The nuns, the parents, the boyfriend, the boss, the cops, they're not going to save you. They're not going to stop you. And it just, you know, it was that moment of clarity. I'm going to die if I keep drinking. And I'm going to look really nice in the coffin, and they're all going to go, God, I didn't know she was that bad. But I'm going to be dead. And I'm going to bypass married and divorced, you know, losing the house, losing the car, losing this, you know, running somebody over, all the things that happen to us alcoholics. I never went to jail, and I've been stopped by the cops on several occasions. And on one occasion, I had, I got stopped 3 times that night. I had gone out after work, went out after work with 2 guys from work that I drank with on a regular basis. And we always went to the first bar, which was a Holiday Inn. And I drank my favorite, well, they were all my favorite drinks, but mostly I drank like straight scotch or tequila or Jack Daniels and soda or stuff like that. And so we went to the Holiday Inn and I started drinking scotch and drank scotch till from right after work until about 11 p.m. And then the guys wanted to leave or something. We left and they were drunk and we were in one of them's little Volkswagen and he was driving and we were going back to the other guy's condo to drink some more. And on the way back, we didn't know it, but Rick's VW had a taillight out. So we get pulled over and just as we pulled into this condo complex and Rick gets out of the car and they immediately cuff him and then they want to tow his car away. Meanwhile, my other friend Dick, he ran into his condo so they wouldn't get him. I got out and walked right up to the cops and said, you know, you don't have to tow his car away. It's right here. I can park it right here. You know, he's going to jail. Just don't tow his car away. And they flashed the light in my eyes and asked me how many drinks I'd had. And I never said two. I always said like, how many, you know, four or five, I don't know. And they went, well, okay, you can park the car. And so they let me park his car. Again, that thing without thinking is I'm getting away with something. I'm not as bad as I think I am. And so I parked his car. Rick went to jail. Dick and I tried to find a bail bondsman, finally found somebody, and we're supposed to meet him in some alley down in town Fresno. So we get, in the meantime, somebody at his house had some corn liquor. And so we started drinking that. I took one, I always took one in the car with me, and I said, well, let's go bail Rick out. So we get in the car, two of us, and I'm driving the Volkswagen, and I have the glass of booze. And we start going down to jail and get pulled over. So I said, give me that fix-it ticket. So the cop comes over. I put my drink on the floor of the car and said, I know the taillight's out. We just got a fix-it ticket. We'll take care of it. He said, okay, bye. So we drive to jail, pick up Rick, and meanwhile I'm drinking, pick up Rick, and he's terrified. We get him out of jail, and he's just, take me home, take me home. I said, no, you're not going home. We have to go, like, drink now. So I take him to another bar, doesn't want to. That's how self-centered I am. He doesn't want to go. I have no consideration for the fact that he's terrified and any of that. It's just, I want another drink, and, you know, let's go ahead. Have drinks and talk about it. So, throw him to this other bar, Nicola's, and we started drinking there. He didn't drink. And so, when it was two, we left there, drove back clear across town to the condo, and just as I'm pulling in the condo, another cop pulls me over. And so I looked at him, I said, Ronnie? And he was a guy who drank at the country bar. The cop was a guy that drank at the country bar. I said, Ronnie, is that you? Me, Benny. He goes, oh. What are you doing? I said, oh, I'm just dropping these guys off. And I just live a couple blocks down. He goes, okay, be safe. You know? And back then, that's what they did. And there were more little scenes like that, too. So I'm 31 years old. I had a boyfriend for 7.5 years who I, well, now I would call it stalking, but I thought I was madly in love with him. And I really was, but I was pretty mean to him, and I was always trying to make him jealous, always doing things to make him, really dishonest things, to make him jealous so he'd love me or something. I don't know. It's really sick. I didn't know that until I got sober. But that, you know, finally fell, and he wasn't alcoholic either, that finally fell apart, and I'm sure my drinking had something to do with it, so it was never spoken. And it certainly had to do with my self-centered behavior. And that I really wasn't capable of really loving another human being sober. So I don't know, I was just really confused about my life and unhappy and drunk all the time and still going to work. But I finally, one night I'd gone out to that country bar with some friends. I'd gone to work that day and I went out to lunch with some guy and had a couple glasses of wine, and I went back to lunch, I mean back to work, which was unusual. Went back to work, And then my friend Dick and I, after work, we stopped at a bar and I started drinking straight tequila. And I was at the point where I wished I could just inject it. And I just ordered two. Just order two, because that cocktail waitress is not going to get back here in time for the second one. You know, and got to get the first couple down, and then, so I'd order a couple shots of tequila and a Perrier or something. And we drank for an hour or two, and he said he had to leave. I couldn't believe it. I'm not done. So we left, and I went home. I didn't live far from there. Went home, and then my friend Susie and I were going to go out with this other friend who rode horses out to the Jim's place that night. So that gal came over and picked us up in her pickup, and we went out there. And before we went out there, as soon as I got home, I got one of those, like, 22-ounce wine glasses, like about this big. I had some. And I took a bottle of tequila, and I filled the glass up. And I remember sitting there thinking, I don't even know why I bother with the glass anymore, you know? Mm-hmm. I was really aware of how much I drank and how often. But I didn't know it was the root cause of all the problems that I was having in my life. And so we went out to Jim's place, and I just, you know, was dancing around, and I just drank straight tequila from the time we got out there until 2. And at 2, we left. Well, they kicked us out. And we left, and some guy that Susie's friend met wanted us to come by his place. So we went over there, and I would do things like, to prove to myself how I could drink all day and night and still function, I picked up like a ping pong paddle, and I'd just do a ping pong ball like that, like, oh, I'm not so coordinated, you know, and I just had to prove to myself I was okay, and I was far from okay. And so we drank some beers there, and I took one with me, and by now, Susie had a drink or two and said, no, she was going to drive because she hadn't drank too much. And then the other gal was sitting by that window of the truck, and I was sitting in the middle, and I was drinking a bottle of beer, and we started to go home, and one of the guys that was with that other gal started following us. And I said, well, ditch him. Ditch him. Don't let him know where we live. And so Susie's driving along, I go, you don't know how to do this. I know how to do this. I've got a lot of practice. And I said, when I say three, you sit up, and I'll scoot under you, and I'll get rid of this guy. So she went along with it. We did that. Now I'm just hauling ass in this pickup truck toward town, and I go away from where we all live, and I go down, going down toward town, drinking the beer, and this guy is on my tail, and I can't shake him. And I pulled into a residential area, and I turned the lights out, and I start weaving back and forth, and then kind of the trucks were weaving, like, and they're sliding and screaming. I go, don't worry, don't worry, it's okay, I can do this. And I was scared. I was scared. I thought, man, I almost lost it there. So we go down. This guy cannot lose this guy. It's never happened before. And I go down to the main street, which is Blackstone, and there's a red light going on to Blackstone. And I thought, I'll just run the red light. He won't. And I run the red light, and he ran it too. And I turned on Blackstone going down toward town, and I don't know how fast I was going, but he was right on my tail. And when I got down to this one intersection, I hit the brakes, and I went to turn right, and the truck started spinning. And it spun down the road, and it ended up facing the opposite direction about this far from a big railroad standard metal pole thing. And he was right behind me, and he pulled over, and there were two highway patrolmen in a restaurant, catty corner from that, and they left their table, got in their car, came over, and all I did was, I'd never been to jail, but I handed the beer to Susie, and I said, I'm going to jail, come and get me. And I was just kind of struck sober, and I was so sick of myself, so sick of myself. And I got out of the car and went over, and the higher patrolman said, you know, walk the line, ABCs, all that stuff. And he said, I know you've been drinking, he said, and I never want to see you on this road again, and yell some other stuff at me and let me drive away. I drove away. And I went home, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was about 3 in the morning, and the lady said, do you want to talk to an alcoholic? And I thought, 3 o'clock, I don't want to bother anybody. And I said, no, just tell me, this was a Friday night, I said, just tell me where a meeting is on Monday night. Now, that was doing it my way. it was not conscious to me, but I just thought, surely I won't drink tomorrow or Sunday. This is it. I almost killed these people. This is it. So Saturday, she told me the address of the Monday night meeting. Saturday, I went to two things I'd planned to go to, and they both had drinking, and I'd had it, and I was so hungover. Oh, I had bad hangover. And my friend said, oh my God, you look terrible. Have a drink, you'll feel better. And I said, I know, but then I'll have another one, and another one, and another one, and there's no stopping. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to AA on Monday. Mm-hmm. And I went to something that night, didn't drink. It was a cocktail thing, did not drink. I went to something on Sunday, and I knew there'd be booze there. And I told these people, for 2 hours, people offered me drinks. And I said, I can't drink. I got to go to AA tomorrow because I'm going to die if I keep drinking. And there's a line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that talks about sometimes there's no thought at all before the first drink. And I was at that place. And without thinking, planning not to drink and turning it down for 2 hours, at two hours of being there, all of a sudden I realize I'm drinking champagne out of a bottle. And, you know, there I am again. I planned not to drink. I had no thought at all before starting to drink that. I didn't say, oh, gee, I changed my mind or anything. I was just not drinking, and then I was drinking. So that's why I keep coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't stay sober on my thinking. And then I had to keep drinking, so I drank another bottle of champagne, and I remember going over to my parents. The only thing I did different that night was have my sister drive us back to my parents, and I still had the second bottle of champagne, and I was sitting at the dining room table with my dad, and I said, Dad, I'm an alcoholic, and I've got to do something about it. It's going to kill me. And he, no, you're not. I said, oh, yeah, I am. And he said, he said, well, just stop like I stopped smoking. And I said, no, it's not that. It's not like that. And so I finished that bottle of champagne, drank a few beers, and went home. And the next day, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and at that address. And that was a very important drunk for me that Sunday, because it proved to me that I cannot, with all the fear of what happened Friday night, with all that bad feeling about myself, with all my self-knowledge, the Big Book tells me self-knowledge will avail me nothing. And that's true today. Self-knowledge will avail me nothing if I'm not doing Alcoholics Anonymous in order to stay sober a day at a time. And so I went to that meeting, and I went in, and the lady who was leading the meeting, turned out she was 7 or 8 years sober. She was almost a couple weeks from 7 years sober. And when I was 8 days sober, I asked her to be my sponsor. But she and three other women that were at that meeting gave me their phone numbers after the meeting and invited me to go to coffee with them. And I went. I didn't know what else to do. I just went with them. And so I went to coffee with them, and this one gal was sitting there. Her name was Kitty. And they didn't tell me what to do or anything, but I told them what had happened on my last drunk and about my drinking. They told me some stuff about their drinking. And then Kitty was talking about meetings. I said, well, it sounds like I thought I would go to meetings like once a week for 2 years, and then I would learn what you learn here, how to stay sober the rest of your life. That it would be an intellectual kind of learning thing. You'd learn how to stay sober. And what I learned was you got to keep coming back as long as you want to stay sober is what I learned pretty quick. But I said to Kitty, they didn't tell me how many meetings to go to, and I said to Kitty, how many meetings do you go to? And she said, when I was new, I went every night. And I knew I have to go every night. And I began to go every night. And all of us that were at that coffee that night are still sober. My sponsor's birthday is tomorrow, and she'll be 40-something tomorrow. And so I just went where they went and did what they did as best as I could kind of try and figure it out. they would say, you know, ask a lot of questions, and I'd think, well, what are the questions? I don't know what the questions are. I was really worried this isn't going to work for me because I don't know what the questions are. And they spoon-fed me Alcoholics Anonymous right out of that big book and the traditions. I was extremely uncomfortable when I was new. I know we all are. I thought I would die in a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not used to sitting next to human beings that close with those bright of lights without booze in me. And it was painful. I felt like I was just going to jump and run. And the reason I didn't was I thought I'll never come back. I'll just never come back. And as painful as it was to sit in those meetings, I wasn't taking a drink one day at a time. And I remember at that first meeting when they said, you know, come back tomorrow night. And I thought, well, how am I going to stay sober? It's like midnight. How am I going to stay sober till 8 p.m. tomorrow night? I mean, you know, I can't eat a hot dog without a beer or have pizza without wine or I just drink. But I didn't drink that next day. And one day at a time, I didn't drink. And I was so uncomfortable that after a few weeks I was at work. I went to work the very next day and started working like 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. It's really hard. Hadn't done that in years. I'd been working for this company for 10 years. I worked for them 10 years drunk and then 10 years sober and was able to make my amends financially. And I was stealing stuff from them in the last 3 years. I turned into a real thief and they owed me all that kind of stuff. So, but I started taking the steps with my sponsor, and she encouraged me when I was new to talk about what I was like in meetings. Talk about your drinking, Bunny. Big book says get rigorously honest. Talk about it. So I talked about it, my drinking in meetings and the really personal stuff. I talked to her one-on-one, sometimes sitting in her car before the meeting, sitting in her car after the meeting, walking her baby around in the baby stroller around the block or sitting on her couch, and little by little all that stuff kept coming out, and it had to come out so more could surface up so I could see the truth where drinking had taken me. And it's a process, and so that began to happen for me. And one day at a time I wasn't drinking, and as uncomfortable as, so I called her from work one day after I was sober a few weeks, and I was really uncomfortable. It was physical. It just, it was awful. And I called her, and she said, hello, always real calm. And I said, it's not working. And she said, what? And I said, it's not working. And she said, are you drinking? And I said, no. Like, no. And she said, well, then it's working. And I'm like, oh, how come it's so uncomfortable? And you know, it's uncomfortable from all the wreckage and all the crap I did when I was drinking. Mm-hmm. All that dishonesty, all that way of living, all that sleeping around, all that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is how the big book describes it so perfectly. All that stuff is starting to surface when I just kept putting a drink on it until I got to AA. And there was relief as it began to come out. And the reason that I was able to let that out is because the women in Alcoholics Anonymous shared their drinking stories with me. And not just in my fifth step, but again, on those one-on-one, one drunk talking to another, in the coffee shop, you know, and the men too. In our little home, our home meeting was on Tuesday night, and it was at home when I got sober. And before I moved over here the last 5 years of my sobriety in Fresno, before I moved here, it was in my apartment for 5 years, whether I was on a business trip or not. And it was there every Tuesday night. And so I grew up in those little home group meetings, and there's a really wonderful camaraderie and intimacy with that. I have lifelong friends. I meet those people that I got sober with who were in my first meeting and have since come along in the years. I meet up with them at AA conferences. I'll go to Palm Springs next weekend, and I've been going down there for 30-something years because my sponsor and her husband, who's sober 40-something years, their sponsors were in the South Bay, and so we were kind of like related to that group. And then some people have moved to to the Bay Area. My best, one of my best friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, Peg, has been sober 34 years, and Peg and I have never lived in the same town, but are as close as a couple of AAs can be. She used to come to Fresno on business, and when I had a year, she came in stumbling into a meeting with 3 weeks, and she was a mess. And I didn't know what else to do with her, so I took her home and fed her what we call newcomer spaghetti. And I just feed Peg spaghetti, take her to the meeting, and take her to the coffee shop, and we both stayed sober. And then we started being roommates at conferences and stuff, so we still do that. We'll be roommates next week. And I became able to be a worker among workers. And when I started the next day, when I went back to work, I had told my company I was going to quit. I'm quitting and moving something bigger and better. And then I got sober. I thought, oh, I think I better stay in. I was going to move to the Bay Area. I'd been doing a lot of drinking. My sisters all lived back in the Bay Area, and I was doing a lot of drinking up there, and had a boyfriend up there. And yep, I'm going to move up there. It'll be better. And I didn't know anything about those were called geographics. But anyway, when I went to that first meeting, I got on my knees when I got home that night, and I said, God, do not let me, please do not let me run away from these people. I knew you knew something that I didn't know, and I didn't know if this would work for me, and I was kind of afraid it would, kind of afraid it wouldn't, because I loved to drink. I loved it. And I was afraid that I would explode mentally and physically without booze in my system. And I never shook in my 10 years of drinking because I never didn't have that steady flow of alcohol. When I was 8 days sober, I went to a noon meeting, and I had started shaking. And I mean, I was like this. It was really scary. I had no idea I was that physically sick. And I was like this. And I tried to call one of those gals, and she was at work, and I couldn't get a hold of her. I tried to call my sponsor, and I asked her that night because I was so scared. That's why I asked her to be my sponsor that night. And so I couldn't get a hold of her, and I told my friend Susie, we were sharing a place at the time. I said, if they call back, ask them what I do, ask them what I'm supposed to do. I was just like shaking. I went to this meeting, and I shook in the meeting, and at the end of the meeting, this guy, well, he gave me a candy bar, and I couldn't get the wrapper off of it. And he took the wrapper off, and I ate it. And I was walking out of the meeting, and I had that boyfriend in San Francisco, and he had he was going to take me to Hawaii for a couple weeks, and it was all planned. And I figured I didn't know how to say no. I'd never known how to say no, so I figured, well, I have to go to Hawaii. But I looked up, okay, there's meetings in Maui. I can go to meetings there, but. When I saw myself shake like that, I thought, I can't go. Well, we didn't have cell phones or any of that stuff. That's it. Olden days. I can't get on an airplane for 4 or 5 hours with booze flowing, and I can't call anybody. I can't go. And I didn't know that I could say no, because I said already said yes. So I walked out the door, and this guy, Painter Tom, was standing there. And he said, just keep coming back. It really will get better. And I said, well, I just don't know what to do. I'm supposed to go to Hawaii, and I don't know. And he said, well, don't go. And that had not occurred to me. And I made a decision right then to not go. And that guy was so, I felt bad for him, because he was really nice, and he wasn't alcoholic either. He said, oh, I called him that night and told him I was an alcoholic. I can't go to Hawaii. And he said, oh, I'll take you to meetings and all that stuff. You don't have to worry about it. But I knew, first of all, I wasn't in love with the guy, and I'm certainly not, like, sleeping with him, drinking since I, you know, that's what I was used to doing. I don't know him that well. And I knew I couldn't do it, and I thought, you know, and I didn't go, and I've never regretted not going. That's what I had to do at that time. And but I kept going to meetings. My group talked a great deal about commitment meetings. Making a commitment to go to myself and to my sobriety, to go on a certain night at a certain meeting, and that would save me from feeling like I had to stay home and watch a certain TV program or, you know, whatever other distractions there are out there, especially when I was new. And I went to a meeting every night, I think, for the first 7 or 8 months. I went to 6 meetings a week for the first 2 years. And have always gone to lots of meetings. I travel a lot. I always look up meetings wherever I'm going, and I make sure that I go when I'm out of town. I love to go out of town meetings. It's really fun. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a really wonderful life. Moved over here when I was 10 years sober to Santa Maria and lived here a couple years and then moved down to Los Alamos. And so I go to the Los Alamos Thursday night meeting, and then I go to my other meetings in Solvang. And I secretary the airport meeting 3 times and, you know, do that kind of thing so that I can keep my foot in the circle, in the clumps, and stay connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have had a lot of successes and failures and business kind of thing. I've been through the hardest things in my life have happened during my sobriety. I've never wanted to drink since I got here. I just haven't so far till this day. And I thought that sobriety meant you might not drink, but you're going to crave a drink every waking and sleeping moment of the rest of your physical existence. And that periodically you will just go into fits of shaking. I thought that the sugar bowls that they had on the table of the first meeting I went to, I thought it was because periodically one of us would go into these weird fits. And they would cram sugar cubes. That's what they were for. I really believe this. They would cram sugar cubes in your mouth to, like, keep you from convulsing or dying or something. And I was willing to do that rather than take another drink. You know, it's the jumping off place. I came to that sober. I had come to it drunk. Can't live with or without alcohol. And I came to it sober. And it's the steps and finding a power greater than myself through practicing, looking for power greater than myself, and trying to go inside and find that, and finding it in you, and in the examples in my life. And I'm eternally grateful to the examples of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that it was passed on to me so purely out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and how precious it is, and how important it is to maintain for the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I take that very seriously. So sometimes people think I'm too serious, but it's life and death. It was life and death the day I walked in here, and it's life and death to me today, 35 years later. And so that's why I'm really privileged to keep coming back to meetings. I want to come to meetings. A lot of people don't when they get a lot of time. But if I never forget what got me here, and I keep practicing these principles in all my affairs, then I get to come back a day at a time and live this wonderful life. And I hope anybody who's new or newer, just grab onto somebody. Don't drink no matter what. Just a day at a time. And get phone numbers of people who are sober and actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and ask them if they can help you. That's what we're here for. And we have to do that to stay sober. And so I love AA, and thanks again for letting me share my story.
All right, let's give Benny another round of applause.
All right, great. And Benny will be available at the end of the meeting. Please, out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous.